More than a million employees worldwide, soaring net profits, hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue each year. We're on a tour across America to see what regional inequalities mean through the lens of the e-commerce giant Amazon, its business practices, and especially the people who teeter on the edge of poverty, subsisting as warehouse workers. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So from your vantage point, do huge companies like Amazon add to the financial divide in our country? Does your community have Amazon as an employer or a warehouse? What are they like as a corporate citizen? 800-642-1234. Alec McGillis is a reporter for ProPublica. His new book is called Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America. Alec, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, that Jeff Bezos company line is really stuck in my head. Work hard, have fun, make history. And I see how it could be motivating for employees with privilege who are comfortably pulling, you know, six-figure salaries, dual income. But the motto seems really hollow for warehouse workers who, you know, make maybe $12 an hour. How do you think about these contrasts as you constructed this portrait of America?
Oh, those contrasts were really at the heart of what I was trying to get at. I came at this book actually not through Amazon, but through my longstanding concern about growing regional disparities in this country, the growing kind of divide of the country into winner-take-all, hyper-prosperous winner-take-all cities and a much larger number of left-behind cities and towns. Yeah, I've been wanting to write about that for years. And after Trump got elected, I realized just how much I needed to write about it because it was having such an effect on our politics, a distorting effect on our politics, these regional disparities and resentments. And I decided to come at it through Amazon, really for two reasons. One is that Amazon is so ubiquitous in our country that it's just a handy way to kind of take you around our landscape to show you what we're becoming as a society, but also because Amazon is itself helping to drive these disparities. So much of the reason that we've ended up with this concentration of wealth in certain places in our country is that we've got our economy so concentrated in certain companies. And what happens is that they draw a lot of the commerce and business activity that used to be dispersed all around our country gets drawn into certain cities, into the headquarters cities of the companies, of the tech giants. And so you end up with a Bay Area or a Seattle that are now just incredibly wealthy and expensive, and then you end up with a lot of other cities that are essentially what I call now the warehouse towns and cities, where you do have an Amazon presence, but it's a much different kind of presence. It's the people making $15 an hour versus those making $150,000 a year in the headquarters cities, and the landscape is really bifurcated into those two different sorts of places.
Yeah, it was really interesting because, you know, here in the pandemic, we've heard how more Americans can work from anywhere. But, you know, that really falls into the camp of higher wage workers who use tech in their jobs. But you also found that tech workers actually need to cluster in these specific cities, the cities that have really flourished under this model. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. It's one reason why I am kind of skeptical of this notion that we're going to see this great dispersal now as a result of the pandemic. I mean, because what happens in the tech economy and what's happened for years is that the high-tech economy has a natural clustering effect, an agglomerating effect is the fancy word for it. And the basic reason for that is that innovation happens in proximity and has for centuries, you know, going all the way back to Renaissance Florence or industrial age Glasgow. You have ideas and advances happen when people are together, not just the sort of inventors and innovators working together, but also being in proximity with the capital, with the venture capitalists that mm-hmm. are going to fund their ideas. And so that's how you have the development of a Silicon Valley or Seattle. One big reason why Jeff Bezos set up Amazon in Seattle was that Microsoft was already there. So he knew he'd be able to draw off that workforce in building his own company. One reason why Amazon has now picked Washington, D.C., which is the wealthiest metro area in the country, in a very costly city. You'd think you wouldn't want to go there to build your next headquarters, but they're going there because Washington has such a large skilled workforce that they can draw off of. So there is this kind of clustering effect nature to the tech economy. Whereas back in the day of the manufacturing economy, you could really go anywhere to build your mill or your factory as long as you had basic manpower, basic natural resources. Now there's this clustering effect where it's a winner take all, rich get richer effect to the economic geography. And my strong hunch is that that's going to continue going forward, even if at the margins it's possible for this or that tech worker to go off and live in a nice mountain resort town or a beach town.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the growing economic divide in America. We have journalist and author Alec McGillis of ProPublica. You can join in. What thoughts do you have about the convenience that Amazon offers and the impacts to people in their communities? Do you or someone you know work for Amazon? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Alec, you know, Amazon calls its warehouses fulfillment centers, which is ironic because the work there is so grueling. And you take us into the lives of some of these workers. And I thought it was really surprising. They have wristbands that track workers and vibrate if you're off track, off task. What is that like?
Yes, the warehouses are astonishingly automated to the point where workers are just being tracked at every moment, that the company's able to know, the supervisors are able to know just how much rate you're making. That's their term for it, you know, for productivity, just how high your rate is and how much, quote, time off task you're taking, where you've momentarily, you know, stepped away from the belt or whatever your job on the floor might be. And so you're constantly being tracked and there's sort of algorithms that are constantly, you know, assessing your performance, and you can be, and then if you start falling behind, you'll instantly have a supervisor coming to check on you and see what's going on, and then you might actually be let go based on those low rates. The company.
Wait, so you could actually be fired by an algorithm, as you put it.
Yes, you can be fired by an algorithm, which the company itself actually pointed to a couple years ago in its defense against employment lawsuit that had been brought by worker that had been let go. It was alleging some form of discrimination, and they said, "No, look, this is completely fair. You've been fired by the algorithm. There's no kind of personal bias involved here." The warehouses just they're incredibly automated. And they've actually, here's one of the key things, is that as the warehouses have brought in more robots, you'd think that might actually allow the workers themselves to be free to do kind of higher order kind of work. And in fact, what's happened is that as the warehouses have gotten more robots in them, the workers themselves have had to become more robotic. The best example of that are the pickers. That's the sort of iconic Amazon job of the people who used to go walk up and down the corridors looking for whatever item we have ordered from the warehouse, and so they would go hunting for the items and then put them in their cart and then bring them down to be sent off. And now what happens in most of the warehouses is that the items are brought to the pickers by robots. That they're these you may have seen them. They're pretty incredible. They're these they look kind of like little ottomans, these orange ottomans that have stacks of yellow shelves on top of them, and they go zooming around. These towers of shelves go zooming around, somehow manage not to crash into each other, and then they bring the whatever the requested good is to the picker who's in a stationary position all day, and it's just picking things off of the shelves as they're brought to him or her. And so in a sense, the robot is now driving the action. You have to, as the picker, you've got to be keeping up with the robots that are bringing you the stuff. And the picking rate is now much higher than it was when you were golfing your own looking for things. You, in a sense, the only reason that you as a picker are still there and have not been yourself been replaced by a robot is that they have a hard time getting the robots, teaching robots how to grab things. That's sort of the last frontier for robots. And so we are still, as humans,
our thumbs are still what's
keeping
us.
Yes, our thumbs and our ability to also to gauge different sizes and shapes. That's the key thing. So that's what's left us still employed.
Journalist Alec MacGillis, he's detailed a look at inequality in America through the framework of Amazon and how it builds up its sprawling web of warehouses and data centers and corporate campuses. What thoughts do you have about the convenience that Amazon offers and how that impacts our lives and communities? Are you a local shop owner or run a business on your main street? Do you sell through Amazon? What have you decided about competing? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alec MacGillis here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a long look at what it means to be working class in America here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. ProPublica journalist Alec MacGillis explores how Amazon has permeated many aspects of our lives. Founder Jeff Bezos, the richest person on our planet, he'll take a space flight next month on Blue Origin, the rocket company he owns. Alec charts Amazon's astonishing growth and the power it has over small workers and small communities where it's planted its fulfillment centers and its delivery facilities. What do you think of it all? What do you think of its incredible dominance? 800-642-1234. The book is called Fulfillment, and Alec MacGillis is with us for the hour. Alec, as we've been talking about the warehouses, you also detail just how dangerous it is. The forklifts and the heavy equipment are very dangerous to operate. And I'm thinking about the accidents that you detail, and specifically Jody Rhodes in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. What happened to Jody as she was drowsy at work?
Yes, Jody came to work drowsy one day, and we found out after the fact that when they did the toxicology report on her, that there was various substances in her system that may have helped make her even more drowsy. But she was driving a forklift that has a rack kind of behind the driver's head, sort of separating the driver's compartment from the forks. And there's a risk with these forklifts that the forklift can actually drive into the shelving, kind of under the shelving, and that the driver can get jammed between that rack and the shelving. And that's exactly and the government had actually warned companies about this and urged them to avoid using these kind of machines or give workers extra training in them to somehow guard against that risk. And that it's called the under risk hazard with these kinds of forklifts. And that's exactly what happened with Jody. One day she was bringing in some goods from outside of the warehouse and bringing them into the storage area. And all of a sudden she got jammed. She drove into the shelves. The front part of the forklift went kind of under the shelving. She got her essentially crushed between the shelves and that back rack, and died from her injuries. And what I found when I got the records of this accident from OSHA, from the federal safety regulators, through a public information request. And what was kind of striking about them was that Amazon initially told the regulators that the injury was not the result of any kind of accident, not the result of any kind of workplace accident. Mm-hmm. Just made it sound like she had just sort of died on the spot from some kind of illness, when in fact it was very much the result of this accident. It was pretty striking to see that. And what was also striking was that Amazon in the end was let off without any kind of fine for this accident. And in fact, a couple years later, at the exact same warehouse in Pennsylvania, Carlisle, Pennsylvania, there was another fatality at that warehouse involving a truck outside. So there are lots of accidents at Amazon warehouses. Most of them, of course, not fatal. But just last week, actually, there was a report that came out showing that Amazon had a much higher rate of accidents at its warehouses than other warehouses do on average.
You've found that Amazon has said that it is very detailed about tracking injuries and about logging them and is very responsible with that.
that is their general response, that they show up as having more accidents because they're reporting them more often than competitors. The experts are skeptical of that and suspect that the actual reason that there's a higher rate of injuries is that Amazon is just driving workers to such a higher degree in terms of their productivity expectations. So you just end up with many more repetitive motion injuries, or you know, injuries that just come often out of workers not being experienced enough. You just have incredibly high turnover at the Amazon warehouses. One other injury I came across, which really kind of jumped out at me, I found deep in some records that I managed to get from an Ohio warehouse. They had an accident at the Ohio warehouse because they had actually put some legally blind, two different legally blind people were assigned to drive forklifts. Mm. And not surprisingly, that resulted in an accident. Thankfully, not a fatal one.
We're talking with Alec McGillis. He's a reporter for ProPublica, author of Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One Click America. You can join in with your thoughts about Amazon and how you see the giant marketplace it has created. 800-642-1234. You know, Alec, in 2018, 1 in 10 Amazon employees in Ohio were on food stamps, and you found nationwide that figure you cited isn't much better. You know, didn't Amazon make a big splash about paying its workers at least $15 an hour? What came of that?
They did, and they have raised the starting pay to $15 an hour. And the food stamp stat I cited was shortly prior to that, and was truly one of the stat got a lot of attention, and it was part of the kind of pressure campaign that led Amazon to raise its wages from 12 or 13 an hour starting to 15. But when you ask Amazon about that, the food stamp stat, one thing they cite in their defense is that they say, look, one reason you have such a high rate of food stamp recipients among our workers is that we have such incredibly high turnover at our warehouses that often what happens is that in a course of a given year, yes, one of a worker who comes to our warehouses might no longer be working with us and is now on food stamps, or they were on food stamps and then they came to work for us. So you have an overlap in the course of the given year, but it's not necessarily while they were with us that they were on food stamps. What that points to, of course, and that's Amazon citing that in their defense, what that points to again is the astonishingly high turnover at the warehouses. And this came through again in a really good story in the New York Times yesterday, showing just sort of all the kind of chaos at the warehouses this past year during the pandemic, when you just had this incredibly high turnover of workers just churning in and out. And that turnover is itself a very sort of damning fact about the company and what it's like to work there. The fact that workers just don't want to stay there long at all. Generally, you know, on the course of a given year, the warehouses have 100% turnover, or even higher. And in fact, Amazon encourages this. That's the key thing, that Amazon sees the warehouse workforce as incredibly expendable. They'd rather you not stick around. If you stick around, you're going to be demanding higher wages for seniority. You might even start thinking about organizing. They're very explicit about this. They much prefer just to churn workers through. It's one reason why they don't actually promote that many workers up the ladder. Walmart, you know, for all of its terrible things about Walmart, they are much more likely to promote workers from the floor up through the ranks of the company than is Amazon. Amazon likes to hire its managers from outside. College graduates get hired from outside more likely than workers rising up from the floor. Amazon likes to point to the fact that they help you get community college degrees while you're working at the company, and that's a nice thing on the surface, but it's another way for them to sort of move you out of the company. After you've done your service.
It's an off-ramp. Yeah. I want to take a call here. Richard in Two Rivers is with us. Hi, Richard. What's your experience?
Well, this is not funny. I used to work for the Teamsters on a dock in New York in 1977, and I made $18.25 an hour, and I work factory jobs now. The cost of living and the raise increase never I mean, we're talking 50 years ago. And it's sad. It's really sad. And not just that, I just want to let you know that what I want you to comment on this is you have to go through an employment agency now to, and then you don't get health benefits. There's nothing there.
Temp workers, yeah. Richard, we're going to get back to your comment here as we talk with ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis, who is giving us a look at economic inequality in America through Amazon. You can join in. What impact has Amazon had on your region? Is there a distribution center near you now? Do you have a family or friends who work for Amazon? What do they tell you? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Alec McGillis after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the vast wealth divide in America and how Amazon catapulted to a league of its own. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Journalist Alec McGillis, he dives deep into the lack of transparency and how communities even negotiate with Amazon when they come knocking. Like in Ohio, where a town hired a law firm and they were so scared of riling Amazon that they withheld Amazon's identity from the lawyers, providing millions of dollars in tax credits, full exemption from local property taxes for 15 years. Is there a fulfillment center in your community? What do you think of Amazon's flywheel business model? 800-642-1234. The book is called Fulfillment, and Alec McGillis is with us for the hour. Alec, Richard in Two Rivers had brought up these temp agencies, these agencies that do the employing of these warehouse workers. What is the role of these agencies and how workers are treated from working for them versus working directly for Amazon?
Yeah, that's been a big issue. And although in recent years, the Amazon has started hiring workers directly more often, and rather than using the temp agencies to just bring workers in, they still use a lot of these sort of human resources contractors to do the actual hiring at the front end, which is a very strange kind of process that I actually experienced, because I did apply for a job at a warehouse in Baltimore and saw just how really kind of alienating that onboarding process is at Amazon.
Did you get the job?
I did get the job, but I decided not to take it because Amazon makes all of its workers, even lowly warehouse workers, sign an incredibly broad non-disclosure agreement, promising not to tell anyone about the job ever. And that was going to be a problem for someone who we decided that it was going to be a problem for me in writing the book. So I chose not to take it. But I did get the job. I passed the drug test and all that. Richard raises another really good point, though, about just about the wages and how there's been this real generational shift in what a sort of rank and file working class worker can expect in this country, and I kind of get at that transformation in the book through the story of a man who spent three decades working at a steel mill in Baltimore, the Bethlehem Steel Mill, that was at one point the biggest steelworks in the entire world, and that steelworks has now been wiped off the face of the earth outside Baltimore and replaced by a warehouse business park, a huge warehouse business park that now includes three Amazon warehouses, among others. And he went to work at one of the Amazon warehouses driving a forklift after he lost his job at the steel mill, and he ended up making barely a third as much at the warehouse as he had on the exact same piece of land at the steel mill. Not only that, but he found the work just way less meaningful, way less purposeful, none of the camaraderie and fellowship that he had at the steel mill. Steel job was, of course, very dangerous. And
he had lost his teeth. He had lost his legs. He had gone through everything in terms of his body working in steel and in all of these really dangerous situations. And then he still needs money in retirement.
He did because his pension got slashed after the steel mill went out of business. Bethlehem Steel went bankrupt, and the pension got cut in half. But the incredible thing is that he, despite all the injuries he suffered on the job at the steel mill, he liked that work, and he was sorry to leave it, and he vastly preferred it to the work he ended up doing at Amazon. And he barely lasted 3 years at the Amazon warehouse before he quit. I mean, it was just completely undignified kind of existence there, where he often didn't have time to even to go to the bathroom, and he would sometimes end up going in the corner behind his forklift. And it was just a very just completely degraded kind of existence from what he had at Bethlehem Steel. And so that transformation of sort of what we have to think of these jobs at the warehouses now really as the new mass employment option for workers in America. This is now that they've The, they're Amazon's the second largest employer in the country now after Walmart, gaining fast on them. They hired an additional almost 500,000 more workers last year alone. This is now the job that, for someone who doesn't have a college degree, doesn't have specialized training, if you just want a job the way you used to go down to the factory or the mill or maybe the shopping mall, now you go to Amazon. And so it just matters. The stakes are so high. So, the nature of what this work looks like is increasingly going to determine what mass work looks like in this country.
I mean, I think the question, though, is, unions, why unions haven't made any inroads. But when you are circulating so many employees who have no attachment, who can't even really talk to each other, you can't create community in order to create a union.
Exactly. It's one of the huge challenges in organizing the warehouses that they are so incredibly transient. I was actually speaking last night with someone who does organizing at Amazon, and he said essentially that one of the first steps in trying to organize the warehouses is simply getting workers to stay at them longer. And one of the ways that they try to encourage workers to stay there longer is to create a sense of family among the workers, some sense of belonging, which is really hard to do because it's such an atomized, isolating kind of work. But they'll do it. They have, they'll try anything they can to try to create that sense of family, even if it just means bringing in food, bringing in enchiladas for workers to share at break time, anything to get workers talking to each other and feeling like they belong, because it is really such a you cycle through at such a high rate, you barely get to know each other. The one worker mentioned to me that, that in comparison to the days of the steel mill, where you'd often roll off your shift and go have a beer with your coworkers, that now, I mentioned that kind of. I said, "Why don't you do that?" And he said, "Are you crazy? Are you kidding me? I would never go have a beer with Joe after work because I don't even know who Joe is. He's he he's there's just there's it's a much, much more alienated kind of existence."
What about stock ownership? What about owning shares of the company? Amazon has said its warehouse employees aren't interested in that. Is that true?
No, yes, that is their general response to when you, one thing I raised with them is the really stark contrast with say the Sears company, Sears Roebuck company, which decades ago gave workers a sizable stake in the company stock. And if and I point out in the book that if Amazon had done similar, that many workers would have had hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of stock value in the company, and Amazon insists that they've offered this as an alternative over the years, and that workers really prefer simply slightly higher wages to the stock stake.
Stock options.
What stock options? One finds that sort of hard to believe that if the option were presented to workers at the scale that say the Sears workers got decades ago, I imagine that many workers would in fact leap at that possibility.
We're with Alec McGillis, who is a reporter for ProPublica, and the new book is called Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One-Click America. You can join in. Do you think the distance between the rich and the poor in our country is growing? Does that concern you? What impact has Amazon had on your region, on your community? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Patrick now in Richland County. Hi, Patrick.
Good morning and a long overdue program. Thank you. You know, I talk to Trump supporters and all across the political spectrum. You know, we talk about how divided the country is. But one thing everybody agrees on, and this is everybody, I haven't met one person yet, the corporations have way, way too much power. And there's some real ground to be plowed there by politicians that aren't sold out to the corporations. There are a few Democrats that are talking the talk. And the solution's really quite easy. Just go back before 1980 and dust off the corporate law, the way it was written up, and the way corporates had to be more of a responsible social citizen. And health care, wealth cap, and tell the corporations are reined in. This corporate state stuff, that's what a lot of the resistance globally is about, corporate state power. So,
Patrick, thanks. I want to get Alec here to jump in on what you've seen, especially in the area of lobbying.
Sure. I mean, Patrick's right that there has been a real shift in sort of corporate values and corporate behavior starting right around 1980, maybe the late 70s. You saw a real shift toward a sort of shareholder first kind of mentality and less concern for broader sort of stakeholder values in the way companies were run. Another really big aspect of this that the book gets at, that Fulfillment gets at, is the way we've also allowed monopolies to grow in recent years. We've really seen a loosening of our antitrust efforts. You know, back in the early 20th century, there was this whole effort to take on the big monopolies like Standard Oil. And then over the 20th century, there was a real slackening of our approach to antitrust. And we now are in a situation where we're really kind of back to where we were in the early 20th century, where you have the Google and Facebook and Amazons that look a whole lot like the Standard Oils of back then. And the big question now is whether we're going to be able to take those on. And there are signs now in Washington. It's interesting. There are real signs that the Biden administration and some in Congress are getting serious about this. And I think you really might see some action to either to somehow break up the giants or at least rein them in somehow. Just yesterday, the Senate approved Biden's nominee for the Federal Trade Commission, a young woman who wrote a groundbreaking law school article just a few years ago about Amazon's dominance. And she's now on the FTC, and she's actually probably going to be the chairwoman of the FTC. And that's a really big deal. And so there is incredible lobbying power on the part of the companies. So it's going to be a huge fight. But you are seeing a real push, much overdue push, to try to rein them in.
We're talking with Alec McGillis, who's getting to the heart of these stories on how unequal life is in America. Do you work in warehousing, in procurement, in economic development for your town? Maybe you're a small business owner. What does the Amazon effect mean to you? Still time to explore at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In the words of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, the company mantra is work hard, have fun, make history. But journalist Alec McGillis, he gives these contrasts in a study of nearly two dozen Amazon warehouses by the Center for Investigative Reporting. It found serious injuries were reported at a rate more than double the national average for the warehousing industry. And Amazon said it was simply more responsive in reporting them. The book is called Fulfillment. Alec McGillis is with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's go to Lynn now in Manitowoc. Hi, Lynn. What is your perspective?
Hi. I just wanted to mention, well, I have now two comments after listening to the previous section. But I just read an article, I can't remember where, that basically Jeff Bezos in his Amazon business does not like to have workers more than 3 years, because basically he feels that they start to get, now they didn't use the word lazy, but that's what he was getting at. So, I mean, when a worker goes in there, they're only going to probably be working for about 3 years, you know, and then, you know, they want new people in there. And the second comment I want to make, I am a small business owner, not in retail, in food service, but I feel sorry for the small businesses out there. This is just going to take over. And, you know, we all work hard. We all work hard to have somebody be taking over something like this.
Mm. Oh, a small business owner, Alec.
Yes, this is, you know, really another big effect of Amazon's dominance is what's been happening with small business around the country. And I get at this in the book partly through through the story of a group of office supply dealers in El Paso, Texas, who is sort of a representative sample of what small businesses are up against with Amazon. Office supply dealers, essentially kind of the Dunder Mifflins of El Paso, mm-hmm. who are getting all this pressure from Amazon to sell through Amazon. That what's been happening now around the country is that because we all are going to Amazon to buy everything, small businesses feel like they have to be selling on the Amazon marketplace, on Amazon.com, and they don't really have a choice but to go there. Otherwise, they're just no one's going to find them. No one's going to buy anything from them because that's where we all go now. And so they feel like they have to be selling there, and Amazon exacts a huge commission from them. Anywhere between 15% and 30% is the typical cut that Amazon gets of their sales, and it's become really the most lucrative part of the retail site for Amazon. More than, well over half, actually more than 60% of all sales on the website are now these so-called third-party sales. It's much more lucrative for Amazon than the old model of just buying goods wholesale and then selling them on the site themselves.
Bezos would say this frictionless selling opens up a whole global marketplace to these small businesses. What do you see?
What I see is something much less favorable for the sellers. I mean, for instance, these office supply dealers in El Paso, their customers are not global. Their customers are local. They sell to local businesses, local school districts, local governments in El Paso. They're now having to sell through Amazon, even though they're selling directly to local people. They're having to sell through Amazon, acting as a middleman and getting their cut. They don't need to sell. They don't want to sell paper or printer cartridges to someone in New York or Berlin. That's not their business. Their business is local, and now they're having to go through this middleman, and it's a real problem. And it's almost as if Amazon is now become kind of a toll keeper, just exacting their cut of really just about any commerce that's happening on the internet. And one always has to start wondering if it's time to start treating them not as a business, but almost as a kind of utility, where if we're really going to go to Amazon to buy everything, then you start to wonder whether we start to treat them as, say, a railroad, as a platform that is a fact of life, but needs to be regulated more as a kind of utility, common carrier is the fancy term for it.
Let's bring in Heather in Madison. Hi, Heather.
Hi, I am a former elected official in a small town in just outside of Madison, and I also was their economic development committee chairperson for 12 years and brought a business park to the community. And I have two things to say. One is that Amazon is ubiquitous in that they touch every aspect of life and all creativity. And your guest didn't mention this, but they also play a big role in cloud computing and how they control the cloud, how much they charge, including scientific discovery, such as human genome sequencing, assembly of those things, privacy. There's all kinds of issues around that regarding Amazon that you guys haven't even discussed. But in regarding economic development, when you recruit businesses, Amazon is just horrible. And me, as the economic development person, I steered clear of them because they really brought no value to the community, and yet they actually sucked money out of the community. The community pays you to bring them, and then they abuse your workers. So it's a really bad situation. I agree with your author, and the general public's just not aware. And how we measure economic success, the jobs, just the number of jobs, not the type of jobs, or any of this kind of stuff. The whole system is bad, and corporate America really is in charge of America, not American citizens. So we need to change the system. It's bad.
Heather, thank you. Alec.
Yes, I mean, Heather nails it as far as the economic development effects and how you actually, you might get some more jobs at the warehouse, but what you're actually doing is you're just draining more of the commerce and business activity out of your communities into the headquarter cities like Seattle. The effect on the local small business is huge. As for the cloud, Heather's absolutely right. This is another massive part of Amazon. It's actually the most lucrative part of the company. Amazon Web Services, they're now just as dominant, even, you know, at least as dominant in the cloud as they are on the retail side. And their huge profits they get in the cloud actually help them to kind of underprice on the retail side and maintain their dominance there. I've got a whole chapter in fulfillment that focuses on the cloud and on this whole sort of network, this landscape of the data centers around the country, where they also get just as many tax subsidies and incentives to build those data centers, despite the fact that the data centers have only a few dozen jobs in each of them. So yes, their dominance takes many, many more forms beyond the retail. And that's one reason why there's so much antitrust talk now, because it really has become a kind of an octopus with so many different arms, so many different parts of the economy.
What can someone do on the individual level, on the local level, in their community? You know, as you hear this conversation, and there's a lot to tackle, what can the individual do?
Well, the individual can certainly, as a citizen, push back at some of these huge tax subsidies and tax giveaways. If there's an Amazon warehouse possibly coming to your area, to get involved in demanding that your community not give away these huge subsidies and be a tougher negotiator against Amazon in that regard. But then we also all have a role as consumers. I've not been advocating a boycott or anything like that. But the fact is that the reason why Amazon has grown so much larger in the past year is that all of us just embraced the kind of one-click lifestyle so much more during the pandemic. Sales increased more than 40% off of an already huge base at Amazon, and that was all our doing. And so now I think it's really important for all of us to kind of moderate those kind of habits as the pandemic ebbs and as we're able to return to the physical world around us, that we actually get out of our hunker down mode, out of that one click mode, and re-engage with our communities, not just in terms of our shopping, but also just other things, you know, getting back to the movies, getting back to the theater, supporting the physical landscape around us instead of just doing everything through that digital realm, where the commerce kind of gets drawn away from your community and into the winter cities.
In our last just couple seconds, do you anticipate Amazon will grow larger than it is?
Oh, absolutely. The fact is that there's even more of our retail existence that could still shift online if the habits that we've picked up and that were intensified in the last year don't change. And Jeff Bezos believes in constant growth. He does not believe in standing still, so he's going to keep looking for other things to take over.
Alec, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was great.
Alec McGillis is a reporter for ProPublica and the author of Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.